Good evening, Mayor and Council. Thank you for tonight's briefing. We have a couple items that are on the agenda, but we're going to jump ahead to C, miscellaneous city managers items. We've got three topics that we want to just give some quick information to Council on, and we'll turn over the first one to Karen.
Thank you. This morning, we met with the FOP and we reached an agreement for a three-year period. So effective October 1 of 2022 through the end of fiscal year 2025. We are meeting with LIUNA on Thursday, and I expect that we will also reach an agreement with LIUNA. We're down to just four articles with LIUNA. So our intention is to bring before Council on November 7th the LIUNA agreement, the FOP agreement, and non-union pay plan. For all three of those, we will be seeking approval for a retroactive across-the-board increase effective October 1. Those implementation date increases are at a minimum of 8.45% for every employee in the city. Some will get a little bit more than that if they're being reclassified to a higher pay plan. So those increases on, they'll be effective October 1. Like I said, they'll be retroactive. They will also apply to the department heads. So I am seeking some guidance from Council as to whether or not you all want us to apply those to the two charter positions, the city manager and the city attorney as well. Generally, when we do a market adjustment or anything that's across the board that affects the department heads, we would apply that to the charter positions as well, but we don't have any explicit written guidance for that. So I'm looking for some guidance from you all today if you want me to add an agenda item on November 7th for the charter positions.
I thought it was in their contract.
It's not, unfortunately. Sandy's contract has some language in there that says that she would get an across, if there was an across-the-board increase before she started, before her start date, from the time that we settled the contract to the time of her start date, that would apply to her also. We don't have any language at all in Mike's. So we could handle it one of two ways. If you all are agreeable, we could either go back and do a contract amendment to each of their contracts to add that language. That would be the cleanest thing to do, and then we wouldn't have to come back every time and ask for a separate motion for the charter positions. Another alternative would be to add a separate motion on the November 7th for those two positions.
Can you do the two charter, the two contract agreements on November 7th as
we
well?
Could, absolutely. We would
and
just be adding one line to both of their contracts.
Have their contracts reopened for this one aspect?
Shouldn't be a problem.
I
did
want
to apply Sandy, and you thought that we would be okay to do that.
Should check with both of us.
So we can bring both of those contract amendments to you all.
Yeah, I asked about this, and they said it was in their contract. I heard it was in the contract already, but apparently it's not.
The contract, if you want to.
The contracts both say that for annual merit increases, that they would be considered for the same thing that the department heads received during the year. It doesn't have any provision for these things that are outside of those annual increases.
And so we're not restricted to the amount of annual raise that we can give them, or are we? To very similar to the
You're not restricted. It says that you will take into account.
Well, because Mike deferred his when it mm-hmm. came back up mm-hmm. previously, and we said that we would address it at the review at the end of the year.
Yes.
So we can capture that there. So I just,
right.
I know for some reason there was a vote on Council for not, or there was a challenge. I don't remember exactly what it was.
I offered to defer it from
right.
Right. That was for the 3% COLA. So these things happen so infrequently that we don't have a whole lot of precedents or
guidance. I think at that point in time, that time he deserved it as well. So I want to make mm-hmm. sure he picks up everything that, he has deferred.
Absolutely. So the contract amendment would have some language in there that would provide for cost of living or market adjustments, those things that apply across the board, including department heads, to also apply to the two charter positions. When you all did Sandy's evaluation, you gave her the 3% COLA at that time, since she had deferred hers, as well as Mike, mm-hmm. along with her merit increase.
Right.
So now for mics, once we put that language in there, I would be expecting both of them would get whatever increase we give the department heads for the market adjustment. We could go ahead and do Mike's 3% COLA at that time, or we could wait until the annual increase. That would be, again,
I would expect
some guidance.
At that time.
Because if we get it, but
at that time.
But if we get it
at
the later time, we make it retroactive back to when he...
It's easier if we're going to do it
to go ahead
and do it. Making it retroactive, we have to do a lot of manual calculations
to
do
that.
So if we're going to go ahead and award the 3% COLA for Mike, I would prefer that we do it in this process. Mm-hmm. So we'll add that language. I'll bring you all an amendment on November 7th, and then we will implement Mike's COLA, and both of them will implement the market adjustments at that time for both Mike and Sandy. And then Mike's evaluation will still be on schedule in January.
I mean, obviously, at the last time this came around, there was some pushback or something from the public. There was the issues going on. I just want to make sure that we don't, if the COLA is tied to this one all, if they're tied together, then it might be hard to get them both. If something,
the pushback from the last one was the VLSC,
right.
And they were unhappy with Mike's performance, and so to give him the 3% COLA increase arguing. But this way it's folded into a contract negotiation,
My concern is that it's going to get on the agenda, and they're going to do this a similar push for that with everything that I've been saying. So I don't know. I mean, I think he deserves it. I just want to make sure
Right. I agree. I think it would be, it would make sense to go ahead and add that amendment that would provide for any type of market adjustment or across the board increase, including a COLA, to go ahead and be awarded at the time that we give it to the department heads.
Okay.
And that way we don't have these, we shouldn't have these issues. If it's included in the contract, then we've got clear guidance going forward.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. The other thing, hopefully on November 7th, we will also be bringing to you all the first reading of an ordinance for each of the pension plans. We are increasing the hard cap, so from 90,000 to 100,000 for both plans. Each plan has a percentage cap and a monetary cap in it. For police, it's 90% or $90,000 is the maximum benefit that you can receive. For our general employees plan, it's 75% or $90,000. So we just negotiated with both unions to raise that cap from 90,000 to 100,000, the hard cap. The percentage cap will stay the same. But you know, the reality is as wages are increasing, it's really not realistic to expect that flat monetary cap can stay the same for an extended period of time. It needs to move along with increases in wages. So that will take two readings. We're in the process now of getting an impact statement prepared for that. I did have our actuary run some analysis before we put the proposals on the table, so hopefully it won't take them too long to put together the impact statement.
Do we have a guess on
the cost?
And on our percentage funded for each of the plans?
We do. I don't have the numbers in front of me, and of course when we bring the agenda item to you, we'll bring you all of that.
Okay.
We do have a cost and a total impact to the plan, but the impact statement will also include all of that, and I'll attach it to the agenda item. Okay. I will tell you that was a much less significant impact than some of the other things that we considered during the process. So, it doesn't have as many people impacted by it, especially not in the upcoming few years. You know, we won't really see very many people hitting that cap. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to have a huge impact for us, but we felt it was important to provide that. Okay, and then if all goes as planned, we would like to get the second reading of the ordinance on the special meeting along with the appointment for council, if you're okay with that.
Currently scheduled for November 14th,
following
Monday.
trying to move things forward as quickly as we can, and technically until we get the pension ordinance adopted, the entire contract is not going to be in effect. So
we're adding that to the meeting where it was just going to be a single issue meeting. Can
correct.
We just make sure, since that's out of the ordinary, make sure that we just notice
that we notice it, yeah. Absolutely. And it will be the second reading, so hopefully it won't require a lot of discussion.
And it's okay to have the readings a week apart?
Okay, I think that gets me
got everything
you need? I
need. All righty.
Thank you.
Jump on to a second topic here. Public Works Director Barron wants to just give you some information. You may recall about a month and a half ago, he came to you to let you know that the solid waste RFP was going out on the street. He wanted to give you some information prior to their start of the negotiation process.
Okay, so this is a very brief information only memo. The committee met and reviewed all the RFPs that were presented. We actually received four RFPs, and then we had one non-bid by Republic Services that just notified us that they would not be submitting a bid. Six separate categories in the RFP completions, and what that did is gave us a ranking of 1 through 4 from the top ranked firm down to the bottom ranked firm. Pricing was only 25% of the review. So it's not pricing based, but pricing does play an instance in that. So what you've got in front of you is the top ranked firm, which is Waste Pro, and then a column that shows a twice a week residential percent increase over the current rate, and a once a week over the current rate. So it gives you an idea of the amount of increase we're talking about that's going to have to kind of come in as we begin the negotiation process. So it's just kind of a sticker shock scenario of what may be coming. Not really any direction at this time other than what we plan to bring back to you will be an A or a B, hopefully negotiated rate. Waste Pro was the least expensive, but that doesn't mean there's not some room for some negotiation in there to try to make it a little better than what we've got.
That's for your information. More to come.
And this is still one contractor has not only residential but all commercial as well throughout the city?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Any questions? Good enough. Okay. Thank you very much.
Item number 3, just wanted to give you a very quick update. One of the things that staff and administration have been talking about over the past couple of months is moving forward with a pilot program for outdoor dining. As you are aware, council approved the initiative for J-Bill going back a couple months or so ago. One of the things that the planning director and her staff had started taking a look at was whether or not there were opportunities to set up a pilot program somewhere in the downtown to accommodate elimination of on-street parking, widening of existing sidewalks, and creation of an actual pilot program by ordinance for city council. At the next council meeting, or perhaps the one after that, you will likely be seeing an item asking for authorization to proceed with creating the ordinance for consideration, and also looking to start partnering with property owners that are adjacent to the pilot test area. The area that we're talking about is 2nd Ave North, the segment between 2nd and 1st, where right now the town center is under construction. That north side is what we see as a pilot test program where we could see how it would work in that particular environment. We've had some conversations with Mark Angelo, who's the owner of that project. He is willing to participate, not just participate in the outdoor dining, but also in the financial contribution necessary to make that full-size sidewalk work. So we want to strike while the iron's somewhat hot, so you will see an item in front of you very shortly seeking some formal approval to move forward. Again, just wanted to put that on your radar because that's kind of a big issue.
He's the only one who will be engaged in the pilot? Or is Seawalk Hotel and Surfer also?
Only those that have food-grade establishments would be able to take advantage of it.
Defined by the liquor license?
That would be written up by the attorney as part of the ordinance. If we do some of the sidewalk work before the ordinance takes place, that's okay, they can't use it. But the ordinance itself will go through a full legal review to make sure that we are not allowing bars to have outdoor alcohol drinking. It's specifically designed for food establishments, and therefore that's who would be looking to benefit from this. Okay.
Cup of Joe is the only other one over there?
I'm sorry?
Cup of Joe.
Cup of Joe could probably take advantage of it as well. Surfer would not. My understanding is they have a standard 4 COP license and are not a not a restaurant. So okay. They would not be able to take advantage. That brings us to our next item, item 4, which is really item A. Which is first tee. I'm going to ask Bruce to come on up. This is something Bruce has been working on behind the scenes for numerous months about continuing our partnership with First Tee and taking it to the next level. So with that, I'll let him go from there.
Thanks, Brian. It's been a few months.
Yeah.
In fact, I was kind of surprised that I hadn't presented or talked about First Tee at all because I had somebody with you, Heather, everybody. So just briefly, I'm just going to give a quick overview. I think everybody knows the First Tee, but just in case you don't. This was started, PGA Tour Commissioner in 1997, Tim Fincham is actually who started this. And this was to make golf more accessible for children. So this is a way of learning STEM, learning the game of golf, learning the core values, not necessarily making PGA Tour players out of 6 and 7 year old kids. So this isn't necessarily for the elite. This is for introductory to the game of golf and its core values. We met with Jeff Willoughby, the program director, in 2019. We'd never done anything, or personally, I'd never done anything with the First Tee, and I thought this would be a way to keep Jacks Beach Golf Club on the map for many, many years to come, because as you become a flagship location, that means you're offering a certain amount of programming, certain hours a week that, you know, basically, it's a very small footprint that they encompass. So this building isn't really going to do anything to the program. They've already been doing this amount of programming here. This is just providing them the site for them to go hide away from the shelter, a better classroom setting, and also more technology. The flagship location gives us some great benefits. We've saved tens of thousands of dollars. The city has. There's a lot of vendors that offer discounts to flagship locations for the First Tee. And we're the one in Northeast Florida, obviously, so we've been able to, and that wasn't the original agreement or the reason why we first signed on with the First Tee. That was just an added benefit that we found out as Trevor was ordering some things through Toro and a couple different vendors. So it's been a nice savings for us, but it is a terrific thing for the city of Jacks Beach, not just for the golfers, but I think for the city also to offer something that nobody else has, a way for families to come together with their kids. And what caught my eye when I first met with the program directors at the beginning was they have a checkbox when a parent is filling out an application for their kids, and the checkbox says, do you need a scholarship? And I was coming up with ways that we could raise funds for these kids that need scholarships by doing golf tournaments, fundraisers, that type of stuff, and they didn't need it. They basically offer the scholarship to the kids who need it. So it's a pretty unique program, and now they're funded, not funded, but they're supported by Augusta, PGA Tour, LPGA Tour, huge with the USGA, and now they're under the PGA Tour umbrella. So the PGA Tour umbrella, I can imagine watching the Players Championship whenever on a Sunday.
What about LIV?
Comment on Livia.
Yeah, well, I'll drop that one. So this is going behind the cart barn?
Yeah, I'm getting to it.
Oh, okay.
I won't jump to the end then. Like under the PGA Tour umbrella, that I can see them doing a broadcast on the Players on a Sunday and saying, okay, here we are, the Players, and right down the street, their local Muni, here we've got this one-of-a-kind building that offers programming for all of these kids, and this would be like a first-of-its-kind building that has the technology inside. So the building it's got a closet. I mean, Jeff Hall, the architect, has been working on this for months, and we've had a number of different versions of this building. The original one was like a 10 by 10 shed behind where they currently do their programming now on the range, and we said, well, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. And so we started talking, and it went from this shed to a, you know, a single wide trailer to, wait a second, let's, you know, why don't we provide a place that they can actually make swings inside? So it went bigger and bigger and bigger, and we came up with this. So yes, the building's going to go right next to number 10 tee box on the right side, basically shoved up right next to the cart barn. It'll be about the same dimensions as far as height as the cart barn, so it's going to kind of blend in. Same height, it's 75 feet long. As far as
what's your square footage?
Calculator.
If you don't have it, don't worry.
It's 75 feet long, 12 feet wide, and 15 feet tall.
Okay.
So it basically covers everything from the existing bathrooms that we have, mm-hmm. all the way to the end of the cart barn. Mm-hmm. We played with the option of just leaving the two restrooms that we've got right there, men's and ladies, for this building. And after some careful thought with Heather and a few people, we said, you know what, let's do this just in case something happens to our restrooms. They're, you know, not accessible. Let's go ahead and put restrooms in. So this building houses a closet that has rooms for tables and chairs to be stored, full restrooms, men's and ladies, and a little patio area outside that's covered. So it goes from a massive golf simulator. The kids can swing, play games, hit balls like on a driving range, learn about golf, play Pebble Beach if they want to, and quickly fold it away and put up a classroom setting so they can do STEM learning, anything that has to do with golf. So it's and it's well protected on the left side in case anyone's wondering our golf ball's going to be hit. So when we first started looking at the site, I thought no one could hit the ball there from here. And slowly, little by little, I start walking over there and I look at the side of the cart barn and there's just like ball marks all over. It was like, how in the world is that possible? So we made it clear to the architect that the whole left side of the building is going to be solid, and maybe even building a wall on the outside of it just to ensure. So that's been taken into account.
What'd you say your dimensions were again?
75 feet long, 12 feet or 20 feet wide, and it's arched and 15 feet tall.
Okay.
And that is so I think, you know, long term for us, this is, and we worked very closely with Sandy on getting the contract together. From a liability side, to make sure we've got all of our ducks in a row, but none of this is costing the city a penny. This is all 100% at their expense. There is a gas line to move or build on top of it. We worked with TECO. Plumbing will be available for them off of us. So everything as far as, you know, turnkey, them coming in, building the building, and having assistance from us doesn't cost us anything.
So you may have noticed in the attachments that First Tee is so eager to move forward, they've already signed the agreement.
Yeah.
without attachments A and B being complete, and it, you know, we hadn't even briefed council yet, but they're very excited to move forward with this project. Chomping at the bit is probably a little bit of an understatement. But before we bring a partnership like this to council for a formal contract approval, we wanted to make sure that we walked you through the history, where we think this partnership is going, and answer any questions that you might have.
I'm a huge fan of the First Tee, the program that they have. I think that's fantastic. And I like this idea. I'd still like to see the plans layout mailed to all of us so we can kind of take a peek at them. But I'm a huge supporter of that.
Yeah, well, there's been some adjustments and changing. The most,
sure.
The most recent one I have from the architect was probably from like 3 months ago still. So as soon as, you know, we wanted to get your blessing and then get more details as far as what it's going to look like and what it entails. Yeah.
I'm somewhat disappointed that if all this work went into it without us even knowing anything about it. So I am disappointed in that. And a lot of resources went into this when we were still waiting on the Urban Trail, Gonzales Park, and these are the departments that we're waiting on for that. So I am disappointed in that. That said, I kind of like the idea, but I do have some concerns. Mm-hmm. Why are we going with just First Tee? And I know that there's all those issues, but there are also other youth nonprofits out there. And are we going to then offer them the opportunity to build something on the golf course because they're another nonprofit? Don't want to end up with another lifeguard situation of a private building on a public land. Mm-hmm. Then it's the whereases. You note that the foundation currently serves youth in the city. How many city youth versus not city youth? Because this is going on city property.
Say that again?
The foundation, the First Tee,
yes,
currently serves city youth, but it doesn't say how many city youth, or allowing them to build on our golf course, and our youth aren't the ones who are really the ones who are using it?
What are you saying, like as in city of Jacksonville Beach only?
Oh, it says it's in the city, and the city is the whereases, it's a Jacks Beach one.
Right.
But no, not that they only serve us, but I want to make sure that they are, that some of the youth they serve are our youth.
Well, sure. But I would also think that a good portion of our clients that participate in our golf course are beyond.
Right. That's a concern that I have. Since we're giving them.
How would you want that worded, or what?
That would be in their reports. I would just like to see demonstration that they actually do work with students, youth from Jacksonville Beach, and not just all from Ponte Beach or something like that. I'm a little bit concerned with the which shall not. This is when City Council has to decide on stuff. The terms, and I know this is contractees, which shall not be unreasonably withheld, conditioned, or delayed. And it all depends on who considers what's unreasonable. And that's a lawyer thing, and I'll let Sandy explain to me why that has to be in there a couple times.
What page is that?
It's in a couple of them. It's first mentioned on page 5 of 30. And then this is just a typo, but it could be a larger type of issue on section 8, page 7. Including maintenance of the foundation, but the F is capitalized, considering foundation with
already
a capital F.
It. That's why the
is the entity.
Correct. We've already.
And then
it.
I'm like, oh, the foundation. Yeah. Wrong thing. Then more. Naming rights and signage, I also have some issues with. If it's on the outside, on the inside with rooms, I can understand that, but I wouldn't like to see big signs on the outside of a learning center.
And we've discussed this with them. They're completely at our.
Okay. I just want to see that in the contract that no outdoor signage is allowed inside rooms. I get that. I mean, that's one of the other places where it shall not be unreasonably withheld, conditioned, or delayed. And it all depends on who decides what unreasonable is. And then finally, vending. I think, and I know that this is to be used just in that building, I'm guessing, but it's not clearly stated that way, and I don't want it to interrupt the current vendor that we already have there. So that's why I'm a little concerned about the vending. And then I have circled the exhibit A and B. There is nothing there, and so I haven't seen anything.
And there won't be anything there.
Okay.
What is your, if you might, don't mind me asking, what is your heartache with the signage on the outside of the building?
I don't want us to be a city with all these signs. I just don't see, if it's at the golf course, the golf course should be the golf course. It shouldn't have these other little signage naming rights. And it's naming rights. So you could have Shad Khan, I know it's a long sport, but you could have Shad Khan Shed there. And I just don't think that that's really what we are looking for the feel of embracing the beach life. I don't think that embraces the beach life. So if you go back to the strategic plan, I think.
What section of the agreement was that?
I personally don't have any problem with the
signage.
The signage for the First Tee.
I don't want the whole side.
Right, of course.
Section 25, it's not noted, those specifics aren't said in there. It just says that in order for them to raise money, they can sell naming rights to buildings and rooms and things like that. And I don't want the Mr. Khan's, mustache on the outside saying, don't forget about football.
Well, and I might add that I think, we don't have any, other than the Benny Furlong Senior Center, which that's a Jacksonville thing, right? And we don't have, do we have any buildings that have people's names on them? Other than the Rhoda L. Martin Cultural Center.
But we have a policy that we can name things after the person's deceased, but I'm just uncomfortable with the naming rights on the outside of the building. What the whole purpose of the golf course, of the Muni golf course, is embracing the beach life, being outside, all that, and then just the more signs, it's more distracting.
What if we just put in there that they could do it to get the money, and it can't be anything other larger than a 1x2 memorial plaque or something.
No, I got you.
I mean, I don't have a problem with it them doing it, getting money and putting some small plaque on it or something, but not.
As long as it's not obnoxious.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying.
Right,
but then you can't define that.
But I think you can.
I think we all understand that signs are very picky.
Right. Yeah. You can define it and just pick a size. You know, 6 inches or
I think we're getting the idea. You don't want to see a 20-foot long neon Nike swoosh on the side of the building.
But then you also have to think about the sign thing, the Supreme Court's thing on the signs, and how limited we are. If we allow it on the outside, we do have limitations on how we can control it.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and I've talked to Heather for a couple times. About that, I think we're all on the same page that we don't want a massive sign there, but we do want to afford them the opportunity for people to say, hey, at least this way, having some sort of sign with an arrow, first tee this way, just a directional, not a massive banner taking over ours.
Right,
so,
and that's different than the naming rights.
Yeah.
And I'm with her, too, on the, you know, about the kids that are served. You know, and I definitely, if we're going to use Jack's Beach public property, I want to make sure that we have Jack's Beach kids that are being served.
I can speak from personal example that my daughter has gone to First Tee, so there's at least one Jack's Beach kid being served. And I know several families. My neighbors, that's another Jack's Beach, that's two kids. So I got three kids from my street.
I'll give you one more, my son.
There we go. So we got four kids from inside the room that we know of. So. Oh, I don't know.
We'll come up with some language to address what you're referring to, which is making sure that some of the first spots have preference to the Jack's Beach community before they start looking outside the area.
Would this involve any additional workforce from us, employees or anything like that? No.
This literally just does nothing different than what we've been doing since 2019. Okay. They come and do their classes. They have fairly small classes based on the instructors that they've got, and they'll do, you know, 6 days a week, 1 hour a day, or four days a week, 2 hours a day. This is simply providing a different location for them to do so.
Sure. I just was concerned with the increase in size. That would be a burden on your staff or having to need another staff member or something like that.
Do you have other nonprofits that do similar activities?
We don't. So you said that, and this was something we talked about at the beginning. This is obviously a concern that Mike brought up at the very beginning. There's not, like, if I'm looking at their competitors, Under Armour Golf Tour is a small tour that you probably never heard of.
I've never heard of
it. It's based out of California. There's just not a first tee competitor, really. No one's like, hey, I'm doing the first tee or I'm doing this. First tee is kind of the only junior golf on in that space. I'm not concerned with North Florida Junior Golf Foundation coming to me saying, hey, we want to build our home in your place like you did the first tee. There's just not a competitor to have that desire. So your concern is noted, because that was Mike's first question. It's like, well, who else is going to come in here saying we also want a building,
right?
And we can't find another entity, another business that would be, hey, Jack's Beach, hey, we wanted to. So we've given that a lot of thought. We're trying to like almost make up people that would come into our office and say, okay, how do we do that too? We can't come up with any competitors.
They're pretty much sole source anyways.
They are.
Yeah.
And is this,
I'm sorry, is this, as I read this becomes our building?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we don't end up with a lifeguard situation, mm-hmm. lifeguard station situation. Okay.
It becomes our building after 5 years.
Okay.
And I'm sure there's Lori Rees to throw in there somewhere that this is an opening up the city to have a junior volleyball building near the volleyball courts, or a junior tennis building near the tennis courts, because it's all public land, and there can be little feeder things into that help build youth stuff.
Or a junior pickleball building.
Or a youth pickleball.
We always come back to pickleball.
We do. So there can just be some kind of a little tag.
Or croquet, for that matter.
Junior croquet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I used to play when I was a kid. But we all did.
I don't think any of those are unreasonable. I think if we were to add those to the existing agreement, I think Jeff Willoughby would say, let's go. So those are easy for us to discuss, add on there, and get that done.
I had a question on page 10. it mentions that the foundation can terminate and cancel the agreement by giving the city not less than 10 days written notice, but we have to give them 30 days written notice. Why is there a difference?
I don't know if Sandy's back there, but
I told her
we're
all
still considering this a draft agreement.
Considering this would be.
Are you on 10-18, Sandy? Because that says 90 days there.
Page 10.
There are provisions for cancellation and termination throughout. And I think probably the difference in there, and I don't have a note with that particular comment in front of me, but our position was that the terms were so substantial in our favor that giving them that 10 days and having that discrepancy would not hurt us. So we talked about many of those kinds of terms, even the language that Councilor Dumont mentioned relative to the approvals being unnecessarily unduly delayed or whatever the case may be. We actually debated that a little bit. And it will at some point in time come down to a determination as to whether or not it is unreasonable. But that fuzzy language actually protects the city because they didn't want us to have really any, in my view, a right to say, no, you can't have this approval. So we incorporated some more terms that gave us a little bit more flexibility, and then preserve the right for us to argue about that at some later time if it became necessary to do so. But those are usually the parameters that you're gonna have when you're starting to talk about approvals. You're either gonna have it without the need of consent, or the consent can be withheld, oftentimes in the sole discretion, which they objected to, or as we agreed on. So, you know, we were just trying to work with the conditions as they then existed. And the idea is that we were going to come out of this arrangement in such a better place than we started it, that we gave them the flexibility that they asked for in as much as we possibly could.
And just to clarify, Dan, so on page 917A, remedies, it says the city shall have the right to terminate and cancel this agreement by giving not less than 30 days, and then
right.
B says that they have 10 days.
Right. And then so if you go into 18, there's a 90 day if they don't have sufficient funds, operating.
Right,
funds.
But that's a different
situation. And I think part of that is also there's just going to be a huge change of position with respect to them. So again, there was this due regard to how much they would have to get done in order to vacate that space, as opposed to us being put on notice that, hey, we're out of here. Because when they're out of there, we own
okay.
the building.
Okay.
So there's really no substantive harm for us.
Okay.
Sorry, I forgot to look for this, but when we were out there, we talked about that, well, we can use it to staff trainings, things like that, if we want to.
Yeah, we'll have to work out an agreement, and not long before we have any kind of grand opening. If there's the need for us to use it and it's not being used, us having some sort of shared rights to it.
And we have a provision already in here. We do have to give them notice, and then they have to agree. So we don't have defined number of days, but there is this requirement for advance notice and the preservation of our rights.
But I thought they could decline as well.
Yeah,
yes,
well, and it says for any reasonable cause, and that was something I had a question about too. So what's a reasonable cause?
That they have to set up early the next morning so you can't do staff training that night?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have to give them advance notice.
Okay.
Let's just say we came in under 30 days. Sorry, you can't use it because we don't have 30 days notice. That would be reasonable under the express language of the agreement. Suppose they have something already planned. No, I'm sorry, you can't do it because we have something already planned. So, I mean, there's no way for us to foresee every single circumstance that might cause this to break down at a time we requested it. But we have had situations in the past where we wanted to utilize our property for events, but because of a lease arrangement or a contract arrangement, we were at a disadvantage in actually utilizing our space. So at least in this draft, we've preserved the right to to get some time if it can work out from both parties' schedule.
And for what it's worth, it's not like there's anything in that building that's a huge need to the golf operation. There's no, you know, no need for staff meetings. We have a giant meeting room at Parks and Rec. We can meet in the dining room. There's not anything this building, you know, offers that we currently don't have that we would desperately need at any point. So.
Is there an expectation of how many participants they're going to have? Or does that conversation come up?
That's completely up to us. So in the original agreement we drew up with them, everything about the flagship requires a minimum X amount of hours on a weekly basis in order for us to qualify. What class size we want them to have, we determine. How many times a week we want them to do it, we determine. So that's up to us. If at any point we feel like, holy cow, we're being taken over, this is too many days, too many hours of programming, you need to cut this back, that's within our rights.
So that's kind of a moving decision. In other words, nothing's been set as far as what the expectations are.
No, I mean, it says in the contract that it's up to us to determine as long as we are within the guidelines of the for us to be the flagship location.
This is unrelated to the building. Very crazy. What's the name of the golf pro that left and went to First Tee? Our golf pro? Steve.
Boots,
thank you.
Oh, Boots Farley? You can't forget that name.
I know. I've been sitting here like, he does the best George Forbes impersonation around this thing. You know, I'm here to do it.
I don't think I have.
Oh, he does the George Forbes laugh. It's pretty solid.
Well, I just want to thank Bruce and Sandy for doing this. I've been a part of the First Tee since I was 16 and drove down to the St. John's Center. And down there on the, just to give a little bit, St. John's, the county course down there, they had a single wide trailer, I think it was, maybe a double wide. It's been a long time on the county course. So, and Brentwood has a building, so we're not, this isn't out of bounds on golf turn puns on what is out there, it's a great organization. My daughter has done the programming at Jack's Beach. They do a great job. All the pros are volunteer, no cost to the city, so I think that's good. I know some that do it and they're legit golf pros. They're not just me off the street giving golf instruction. So I know Sandy and Bruce put a lot of effort into this. Jeff's a good buddy of mine, so he's kind of kept me updated on the progress, and these guys have been working really hard. So thank you all both for working really hard on this. And, I do want to make sure, because they're committing, roughly $450,000 building, and I want to make sure that they can secure naming rights for that and secure. I mean, if NEFBA and those kind of guys are going to donate to help build it, I want to make sure that they can get some recognition, because I think that is incredibly important. But I definitely am very cognizant of there not wanting to be a neon lights sign out there as well. So I think that we can really be something special. Brentwood's, I know, will not be near as nice as this, so we will, in all of Jacksonville, have the best facility for the First Tee. And based on what y'all are doing at the golf course, we have the best municipal golf course in the city, so we have a chance to really, I think, elevate that property here. So I'm very excited for this project.
Thanks. Yeah, I think the signage just to go further. We went into, they requested, they're ready for us to say no to the neon, no to this, no to that. What can we put on the inside of the building to thank our sponsors when they come in, right? So they're understanding and they're willing to, be a good partner and not put a neon sign, but still want to be able to thank the people that are funding this $500,000 building that we get to keep after 5 years if things don't go.
Seeing a lot of heads nodding. I think you have your direction.
Great job.
Well, I'm the guy that started the idea, but really this has all been the legal side of this has been my biggest concern, right? All the questions that you're asking, this is something we've been asking for a few months just to make sure that we make her happy and make you guys happy. I mean, the concept is great. We'll have a great building, a bunch of kids, happy families for a long time, but we want to make sure we've got all of our ducks in a row.
Thank you.
future golfers.
Future golfers.
So do we bring this back to briefing or to...
I think when we have an agreement ready, we bring it back to council for consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And off topic, yeah, just to let you know, you'll be getting an email here in the next week or so inviting you for November 10th for our driving range soft opening for council, for media, VIPs, kind of like we did when we did the golf course. But the lights are installed, up and running, and we're going to wait until you... for us to actually flip the switch. That's just a few days after we lose daylight savings and we go back to standard time.
Wasn't that switch already flipped for an event?
Well, maybe.
Wait, but so I did notice that.
It looks great.
This will be our official launch. So if you can mark your calendars, we'll just have you for an hour. So it's not an all-night thing. We'll probably go 5:30 to 7 o'clock or so. So just mark the date and you'll be getting
I do not want it to be dark at 5:30.
Instead of golden shovels, you all get gold pitching wedges.
Oh, dude, I'm in. Gold putters?
Gold putters.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
Thanks,
Rich. Hey, Heather, you're up.
Mine's got to be left-handed, though, Bruce.
We've got those.
All right, good.
Our final topic of the evening is to discuss short-term vacation rental program with an update. We do have about 40 minutes before we have to do a hard stop because the Planning Commission starts up next door and Miss Ireland will need to be next door. Plus the speakers will kick on. So I'll turn it over to Heather.
Thank you. A couple of months ago, we got an inquiry about the status of the STVR registration program. And as I started looking at the numbers, I started thinking about why we might not be getting good compliance with the program. So I talked to Mike about, you know, having a little more time to look into it and talk to some other staff and really look at the ordinance and see maybe what improvements we could make. But just to give you all just kind of an update, I looked on October 3rd at Host Compliance to see how many properties they had identified. The number at that time was just over almost 1,600 properties. I just kind of want to point out that not all of those are required to register with the city. Some are one bedroom in an owner-occupied house, a condo, a couple in Ponte Vedra that's just renting out for TPC weekend, for example. So it's a real mix of properties. It's near impossible to say how many of those would be required to come into compliance with our ordinance because it all depends what they call their property. So just kind of given raw numbers here, they have identified addresses for around 80%, they being Host Compliance, and around 818 active listings. And again, I can look today and those numbers will be totally different. We could have anywhere from, 600 to 800 at any given time as far as what's active, which means it has a listing that's out there that I could go rent right now. I think all of you were here when we did the ordinance for short-term rentals. I think the main purpose of trying to get them registered was obviously to, have a contact information. So when we have a problem with the property, we have someone we can reach out to and say, hey, we have a problem. And secondly is life safety. So we can get fire marshal or his staff out there to inspect these properties to ensure they have working smoke detectors and exits and things like that.
Can I just add, though, that another big issue was that a lot of them were not paying the taxes that they were supposed to be paying.
That, too. And I have that
county,
on my list to talk about.
Local,
yeah,
all of it.
You're,
I mean,
you're
they
absolutely
were just
right.
doing nothing.
And a lot
I
of mean, them still of them. Are. So when yeah. we send out our letters around every 3 months, we break it down into, if you're this type of property, you have to do that. And we tell all of them, even if you don't have to register with the city, you still have to pay state, county, and local taxes. If you look at our numbers for who's applied versus the fire marshal's numbers for who's gotten an inspection and the clerk's office numbers for who's paid taxes, they're all different. Because different properties are having to do different things, or they're doing one thing and not the other. So, you know, as we're sitting down and looking, like, how can we get more people to come into compliance, which, as you said, will obviously bring in more taxes as well, we all got together and talked about what we thought were some of the problems. And one of the big things we think is just that the ordinance itself is really cumbersome. The application process is maybe more difficult than it needs to be. I think if it were a little more simple, we might get more compliance. And so we kind of had some ideas on what we could maybe change in the ordinance to try to get more compliance with property owners and management companies registering properties. There's other problems with the ordinance as well. There's a whole section on vesting that really isn't applicable anymore. There's standards in there that we really can't enforce, like occupancy. You know, we make jokes about counting toothbrushes and things like that, but it really is something we can't get a good handle on. So we kind of had some ideas on ways to maybe make it more simple for applicants and for staff as well to move the process along quicker so we can process applications in a more expedient fashion so that we can get those property taxes and the county can get those tourist taxes. And so obviously we're here to hear what council's thoughts are and answer any questions that you guys have regarding, you know, what we've been doing up to this point and where you guys think we should go from here.
And we do also have the fire marshal, the police chief, and the city attorney all here in case you have questions. The other thing I'd like to point out is this has been fluid every year that the preemption has been in place. I think Sandy can vouch for the fact that over the last 3 years on Florida League of Cities, there has been multiple pieces of proposed legislation to amend the preemption and how it affects local government agencies. The one that was proposed last year, and it ultimately stalled out in committee, was one that would take municipalities down to a registration process only with a cap of $50 per registration. But there were some other things on the back end that became more favorable for us with regards to what we could do for enforcement. So, you know, I would not be surprised if we see another two or three discrete pieces of legislation get proposed again this year. Perhaps it get whittled down to one, and then it's a matter of whether it moves forward or whether it dies somewhere along the process. But that seems to have been the theme every year for the last decade that I've been on that committee and seeing what's been going on with short-term vacation rentals.
One of the things that I think was very positive about last year's legislation was that they definitely were trying to do some things so that bad actors could actually be penalized, you know, like DBPR would like revoke their license for 30 days, you know, which in some cases may not seem like enough, but you know, but they actually had that in there. And right now we really don't have anything that we can do. We don't have a stick.
I got a question. Of course, the law enforcement arena. So it would be for the chief. Chief, so when your officers respond to any kind of incident at a short-term rental, do they, let's just say that they had to document via report, or even if it's online through their laptop, do they make a note that the location that they were at responding to was a short-term rental? And if not, is that something that we can include in an incident report where they just at the very end put STR or something like that? That way we can have some foundation for tracking incidents that happen at short-term rentals.
Yes and yes. Usually the caller says short-term rental, that's the main complaint. So the officer goes into it knowing it is. I told them to worst case, nothing's going on. At least documented no short-term rental, no activity.
Okay.
Or if there's a contact card or it's a party,
right.
Everybody's legally parked, but the music's a little loud, they'll say all legally parked, can't park in the street, told renter to turn out the music.
So that becomes trackable.
We're tracking it. Usually it's not a question of a short-term rental, everybody in the street knows and
right,
they're
right,
calling.
Right.
That's why they're calling.
Right. I guess generally if you have to make contact with somebody at a restaurant, at a residence, they're gonna tell you anyways, we're only here
sure.
for a week. Or,
sure. And, you know, part of it is we show up and who's the owner, I don't know, what the company, who are you, how many people are staying here.
Right.
Yeah, and information.
I just wanted to make sure that we're
yeah,
tracking.
Yeah, we are documenting. I reiterated that after the homicide out there, the other one, that we need to track it all anytime we do a short-term rental, whether it was something all the way to nothing. It needs to be documented on one form or fashion. There are multiple ways to check.
Perfect. Thank you.
So Heather, I mean, just read. I was just reading these. Proposed changes. I mean, I didn't see any problems with any of them. Do you want to go through each one, like really
sure.
briefly?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So again, one of the issues that I think some property owners might have when they look at the ordinance, I mean, we gave you guys a copy, it's not a fun read, it's long. And again, it was copied from Flagler County to some extent, so it may not have been the most appropriate ordinance for a city like Jack's Beach, but I think some owners are confused whether or not they need to register in the first place. You know, what kind of property am I? So a thought we had, and it would result in more work on the part of staff, but requiring all properties to register, with the exception of the owner-occupied, because per statute, those aren't considered. If I just am renting out one room in my house, the state doesn't consider me a short-term rental, but pretty much everything else is. So right now, we're only requiring single-family, two-family, and townhouses. Well, even the question sometimes is it a two-family? Is it a two-unit multifamily? What is it really? Is there a garage apartment? Is it now multifamily? So there's all these questions, not for us, not just for us, but for property owners as well. So that's one potential
I'm
thing
fine
is
with cleaning it up.
Yeah,
all
property
fine with just all, rent.
Yeah.
But all that said, also kind of simplifying the process so that when we get in 800 applications as opposed to 200, we talked to the clerk's office about possibly treating it like we used to treat home ops when we could regulate those, where it was. They came in with their local business tax and they checked a box that they were a home oc. So we talked about maybe doing something similar where they check a box, they're an STVR, we get additional information from them, their DBPR license, but we think the main goals, again, are knowing who to contact when there's a problem. Like Chief said, sometimes they don't know who the owner is, the renters don't know, the neighbors don't know, they live in New York, there's no one to call and say there's a problem. So maybe making it easier and quicker will get that increased compliance.
I don't know how you make it quicker, though, because, I mean, don't we want them to show proof that they are registered, their license with DBPR? Don't we want them to show proof that they're, you know, paying or the bed tax, that they signed up to pay
and
the bed tax?
We do, but I think that's been part of the holdup, too, is that we're the last step in the process. And again, they're all already operating by the time they get to us. That's how we know they're out there. We find host compliance finds them, we send them a letter. We're like, hey, by the way, we know you didn't know because you live in Wisconsin or whatever, but you need to do this stuff.
Can I hop in on that?
Yeah, please. I was going to defer to you on what you guys require for
other
businesses.
The clerk's office here, too.
Over here. So we have a huge part in this as well. Equally, we get the phone calls and the questions and the walk-ups. You know, I have this type of property. What do I do? And like Heather said, we hand them this packet, and I'm like, what do we do? So what you were just speaking of, even for the most complicated local business tax receipts for us would be a restaurant because they have the alcohol, the doggy dining, and all these different things. All we require is articles of incorporation, driver's license, and state approval from DBPR. We inform them and tell them that it is required to have anything that they need from Duval County, but in order for them to get a local business tax receipt with us, we do not require a copy of Duval County stuff. We do require the state. So with Duval County, the bed tax and the registration with them, that can be a holdup with Duval County that is holding these folks up registering with us. We get a list from Duval County, I think you guys get it as well, about once a month, that gives us all of the short-term vacation rentals that have registered with them. So we have that list, but of course there's a ton of people that aren't registering as well. I ran a list today, and we have on the local business tax receipt side, which does include condos, which do not have to go through the long inspection process. We have a total of 86 local business tax receipts for short-term vacation rentals, and half of those are condos that don't need to go through planning and developing for inspection and stuff like that. So there is a disconnect with people coming in saying, hey, I have a short-term vacation rental, and then them completing the process, which ends with us.
Do you find people coming in under an LLC and saying, well, the business has it, and do you require a point of contact from a human being?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Both. Most of them are registered as LLCs. But we do have owner information that's okay. required as well, contact information, email address, cell phone, and all that stuff. It's just, I mean, I'm with Heather. It is a very tedious process. There's a disconnect of, because right now, in order for them to come to us and obtain the local business tax receipt, which is the final step, they often get stuck in fire inspection stuff. And, you know, when you've got 300-400 inspections to do that are pending, whatever, they're still sitting there.
That's not.
That's not, well, I'm not saying that on your end.
But for I think to Jody's point, for ones that may fail an inspection, you know, the fire marshal notes there's something wrong, they've got to do some corrections.
Yeah.
He may never see them again, even if he reaches out and says, hey, just a reminder, you need to schedule a reinspection.
Smoke detector.
60 days later, they may have sold the house and we will never hear from them again. I mean, there's all kinds of scenarios. So our thought was to maybe let them run these processes simultaneously, like we do for other businesses. You know, one option to consider is, and it's in the ordinance, we haven't done it yet, so make a whole bunch of people mad if we do this, but sending the list to Duval County and letting them know how many people are claiming homestead exemption, sending it to the state, saying these are all the short-term rentals in our community, and let them reach out and try to collect their taxes and tourist tax and stuff like
we
that.
Do so that.
We haven't done it yet. Yeah.
That sounds like a great idea.
We could do that.
I don't understand why we aren't. Right? We should.
Yeah.
It's something we could do. We just have to find the right person to send it to that's going to do something with it. So it's something that we can certainly do. We just haven't done it yet. As we're kind of entering this third year of compliance and seeing that we're not getting good numbers of applications, at least not in our opinion.
So right now you are not cross-checking our registrations with the county, even though the county gives it.
The county sends lists of people that
sometimes. The county sends it to you. Do you send the county anything?
We haven't yet, no.
Okay, nor the state.
We haven't
whatsoever.
I haven't yet.
In the last 3 years, not through. That kind of gets to, I have a list of questions, because I think that email that you're referring to, a whole bunch of questions, was from me. So I'll let you, when a code violation is noted, how are they addressed? And this is a hodgepodge of questions from all different sources.
Depends what it is. So parking and noise, obviously, you're going to go to police. Trash usually either comes to code enforcement or public works or a combination of the two. Again, sometimes the problem is we get the complaint, it comes in on a Saturday, we get out there Monday, those tenants are gone, the issue's been resolved. A lot of the complaints, the bulk I would assume we get over the weekends and not during the week when we're here, you know, 8 to 5.
Okay, and then
can I address this? Sure. What usually happens is we get the complaints come. The majority of the complaints come in through our webpage, city webpage, on the code complaint. And when they come in, I get a copy of them. Nikki gets a copy of code enforcement. Now, I'll go out and cross-reference to see if they've been registered in my system with fire. Usually, if they're not in mine, they're probably not in Heather's either. So first thing I do, go get all the owner information and everything to bring them into compliance, to get them started the process going. And send them a violation notice, tell them, hey, you're not registered with the city, you haven't had your annual inspection. So that gets them in the process. And as soon as I send them that, I get the email, I get it off the electric records. I do it by email to them. They're calling me back and trying to come in compliance at that point, at least with my part of it. Come in and doing the rest of the process with Jody and them, I don't know about there. I've got a copy of those complaints of how it's worked, you could get from, if you haven't got them already, where you can see that. But us actually going out and taking that list that Heather sends out, so manpower intensive, to go over that, it's just not realistic in there. But,
oh no, this would be the complaints that are made. Does enforcement and violations consist of a nasty gram letter, an enforceable fine, a cease and desist order, a lien against the property, or a benign slap on the hand?
Yeah, it's not. And we can't do it. As Heather was explaining to you, I tell them all the time, especially, you know, send out whoever sends a complaint, look, you need to call the police department when that noise happens so they can come out at that time and verify it. As Heather was saying, We come out there Monday morning, of course they're gone. It doesn't mean in the parking and stuff. So this is where the chief.
How many complaints do you get?
You know, I don't think the complaint with our citizens is whether people are registered or not. Being the end user, when the officer shows up, here's what the citizen wants. They want the people to go away and no short-term rentals in the city on the street. That's what they want. They could care less whether anybody's registered. They could care whether or less they're paying business taxes. They want them to go away. And the disconnect is not on our end with registration. The disconnect is on the citizens' end on what we can actually do, which is basically nothing. And that's where the disconnect is. It's not in all this process. They don't want them in their neighborhood. Whether there's two people there in the park or 10 people, or they don't want them next to them, period. And the disconnect is we can't prohibit that. And even if we could prohibit it, I don't think we'd be able to manage the process. If we could do it by ordinance, we would have to go around and verify who's renting, bank accounts. We'd have to run a detailed criminal investigation, civil investigation, where the money's going. But I don't think the average citizen understands the complaints I get. They don't want them. The parking, you know, they just don't want them in their neighborhood. And that's where the disconnect is to me. It's not in the process.
That's where all my response is. My response, I tell them, we are limited, the state is limited, what we can do in here. It's, yeah.
But I think we can increase the barriers to entry. You know, I know we can't prohibit them. There's only so much we can do about them. But if we hold them to a higher account in order to even get into this industry, that'll be, I mean, Jacksonville Beach was a very easy place to start up a short-term rental for a few years there. And I did want to say, too, 2019 was when we did the original legislation. So you guys weren't on council yet. So we
I
do
can't
have,
remember who was here, yeah, who so wasn't.
We do have some new council members on it, but we went from 2019 implementing the legislation to 2020, everything shutting down. So we really are just now kind of getting into a normal flow on this. So I'm glad, I think the time is right to be talking about it. And I do agree in theory with your bullet points in terms of streamlining some things. As far as that goes, a few things I just wanted to say while I know we're still on your list of questions, but really quickly, the host compliance also found a lot of scammers. So a lot, some of the, so the numbers are really
they're
a moving target because one of them was not Comfort Inn, what is it now, Hampton Inn, that people were renting out rooms for like this exorbitant amount of money and they're like, we're not short-term renting.
They do it at all the hotels. And we've let them know, like there were some lady listing rooms at Margaritaville. We let Margaritaville know, like just FYI. So yeah, the number is really, I don't put any stock in that 1500 number.
Then I wanted to say really quick, the occupancy issue isn't necessarily about counting toothbrushes of who's actually there, but how many people they can advertise for.
Right.
I know I went to Nashville and I thought I was like a 12 person Airbnb and it could have slept 20 people easily, but they couldn't advertise more than 12 people or they knew they would have gotten shut down. So I think there is still some merit to that. But
and I think on that note, I do think our occupancy personally is too high based on the properties that I'm seeing that are for rent, these three bedroom properties, and they're listing it for 12 people. I mean, I don't want 12 people in my house. That's too many people. So you know, that's something I think to consider as
but
well.
But if it's three bedroom, it would only be eight.
Right, and that's another thing we're seeing is they're listing it too high based on the ordinance. We tell them what it should be, and we're hoping that they're not renting for more, but even that 16 max number, it may be too high. And I've looked at some other ordinances for other places, and it's all over the map with how they do occupancy. Some are max 10, no matter how many bedrooms you have, and everybody does it a little bit differently. So I think we just need to find what's going to work for us.
Since you brought up post compliance, Granicus, how much is Granicus consulting costing the city?
I think this year it was $24,000, and that's for them to locate properties and identify addresses. And they send out the letters.
Are any of that back in on the registrations from the...
It's not paying for itself, no.
It's not paying for itself. Mm-hmm.
Even the registration fee of $150 doesn't pay for itself.
That doesn't pay for
the staff time. No.
To go do inspections.
It's priceless.
That's true. Thank you. It may just be kind of the cost of doing business, if you will, to get people to register. So we do have that contact, and we do have the ability to do life safety inspections.
And again, the last proposal at the state level was to take the registration fee down to a flat $50.
Max, yeah.
And that would include for multi-portfolio applications.
$100 for the
collective. Multi-properties.
The multi-registration. Yeah. No. Oh my God. Yeah. That's what our legislators
definitely are not going to make our money back.
Are doing.
No.
We're stuck with that.
And then there's also a step process. I've got a lot of questions. There's also a step process. Like our ordinances, like at your first time, you get your hand slapped. Second time, eventually you can get your license revoked for 30 days, right?
From the states.
Right.
Well, no, that's not. That was in the proposed legislation.
That
that's
was proposed,
not in the current.
Yeah.
But again,
yeah.
What does that? What does that mean? Honestly,
it doesn't
mean anything to us. Nobody's going to go padlock the doors.
The city can get to a point of issuing fines against the property and revoking their local registration or certification, but that has no impact on the state's license to the individual business and their ability to operate.
So, do we put liens on the property? Is that how that works?
If we could, if they don't pay or they haven't corrected, but the reality is that all we're doing is slapping them on the wrist and they're continuing to operate.
Sure.
But so we can't shut them down.
Nope.
We can fine them.
Yep.
But
after having gone through a magistrate process.
But there's nothing that so they can be fined forever and then it'll be a lien, but just because the fine's open, we can't shut it down.
Correct.
And they can still operate even if they're not registered with the city. Without any problem, without being taxed.
They have to prove they're violating or something. Like, yeah.
Can you send this recording
and
to Tallahassee?
Yes. And I think it'll be easier to I'm sorry, do what?
Yeah, I was just going to say, on the local level, we do have a provision for revocation of our certification for certain violations. But your point is well made, because even if we revoke our certification, doesn't mean we have to stop operating. So it's a really empty process. So, you know, and then there's a question of what kinds of violations would trigger the possibility of revocation. We have to petition the court for that.
So, like, one of the things that we really went into detail with when we designed this was fire safety. And you have to have a fire extinguisher. And, like, we get that whole conversation. And they don't have to do that.
No, they have to do that. The fire code will take care of that.
Okay, so you can make them have a fire extinguisher.
We can correct on those things, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But if they don't have one,
right.
But let's say you say a fire extinguisher and go, doesn't go with the interior color, it'd be of a beachy blue light colored vibe. So, but you can't shut me down, you can't find me, you can stand in my front yard and point your finger at me.
I can. Yeah,
what are the tools that you could use?
It's the normal fire code tools for that, the normal thing. And special magistrate up to closing them down, depending on the severity of the hazard that's there.
But can you?
If it's an unsafe condition in the building, I can. Well, stairs, we've had stairs that weren't safe to walk on, and we've had to make them correct that.
No banister.
Yeah.
Smoke detectors inoffensive.
Right, but I guess to me it was
there's
a reason why I'm really focusing on the fire extinguisher, because we say they have to have one. But if they don't have one, you can't say that not having one makes the building completely unsafe and we can shut it down by fire code.
Yes, I had to give them a few days to do that. It's a time period to do it. I have to follow where it lines out there. But if it's unsafe, like the stairs aren't safe and there's no banister and things like that, no, it can be, at that point, it can be shut down.
And then do you just revoke their certificate of occupancy or something?
It's just on a life safety hazard, which they go and correct. It has nothing actually to do with their certification for a short-term rental. This is just on the standard fire code violation. You know, it's like Gene Paul and any police thing that he runs into when he finds it. It's based back on those codes. And really, we're not finding our bad actors, the Mike Vincennes and things. He's one of our better ones now. He's come into compliance. He has about 20 of them out there. And he makes sure he calls to get them inspected and everything else. We've got four companies that are really good. I don't know if it's a plus or what for Real, but they are saying it's getting hard to rent these things out. The market is saturated right now, and you know, so that's it. What we're finding is some of those on these complaints and things, it used to be all the over on Horn and stuff. Now it's come down to a couple single homes where they've gone in, and the McHugh's old house and things, you know, six bedrooms and stuff, and then they're trying to get, you know, 16 people advertising, but you got to pull this off. You can't advertise 16. You can only have, they can actually have 14 because they have six true bedrooms in that place. But trying to get them to correct that. And I tell them, one of the good things on there, when we go out there and talk to them, they talk to them, you need to go meet your neighbors. You need to get, that usually helps where I don't get those return calls. The neighbors start working together. And I know we've had one, it was on trash can complaints. Well, they hired to bring in the trash cans and do the trash for them and things like that. But neighbors working together and talking to each other seems to help a bunch.
This is something that really needs to really be addressed with the LEC, because parking is another big issue, and we can't regulate the parking any more strictly than we do housing. And I don't know, I don't know how to fix that, but yeah, parking is a...
One of the things I tell them, that roundabout where we had the shooting down there, they said, well, they park in there. I said, yeah, they tell me, I went out to take a look at it. I said, well, these are the cars here. I said, well, they're those neighbors, they live there and things. I'm like, you're not going to be able, they want to do something with parking, but they can't park there, but we can't. Mm-hmm. I don't know how, you know, the chief and
those are legally parked there.
Yeah. I said,
but yeah, I think you're fine. I had no,
Well, and again, these are just our thoughts. Again, we met our planning department staff at the clerk's office and fire marshal on several occasions and just try to brainstorm, like, how can we fix this? Again, the state could probably try to preempt us in some fashion again. We have no idea what that's going to look like. It's been a little different every year. We just kind of prepare for something.
Who will their new champion be, I wonder, for the short-term vacation rentals?
That's in your committee, isn't it?
That's in our committee.
Yeah. No, I mean the champion on the
top
two. Yeah, the replacement sponsor. For sure.
Don't know.
Because he was done.
Is
he running for president?
The good news from what we're hearing from Florida League of Cities staff is that there are a number of elected officials across the state that are getting phone calls from their constituents saying we need to have more control at the local level. Now, whether that translates into anything meaningful, don't know. Roll the dice, see what happens. But at least it's not as blunt and slamming the door in your face as it was just 3-4 years ago. There's at least a willingness from some elected officials to not only listen, but to be willing to put some bills forward with, in some instances, some beneficial regulations for local jurisdictions. It's just a matter of whether we can get the right one and get it advanced.
I feel for the people who have vacation rentals near them, that, you know, every weekend there's a party and it's loud. I mean, I had one that was behind my house several years ago, and it was not fun. It was not fun. And, you know, we got to have a way to do something, you know, I mean, because people's quality of life is being impacted, and that's just not right. I don't know what it is, but we have to be able to do something.
You've heard the frustration from other elected officials for 3 years on that committee. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's a boiling point across the state at the local level.
I think from 35,000 feet, it's kind of like the downloading of illegal songs 10 years ago, or Uber, the Uber problems. It's, I don't know that you fight it as much as you try to regulate or get your hands around it where you can control it, because you're not going to stop it.
Yes.
It's
here. Right, right.
So it's about controlling it. I have one 2 doors down from us, but somehow this guy, thank goodness, he's somehow managed a, I don't want to say a contract, but he's got his clientele's all coming from Mayo. So they just come in here for their loved ones.
They don't feel well enough to the party, probably. Right.
I've got four on my street now. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, because somebody just bought the house, they turned it into a vacation rental. One across the street,
cost
and
effective.
Four on my street.
Yeah. How is that?
I know.
Never had a problem.
I get why it's
on point plus
in our neighborhood.
Yeah, why would you?
On the table up here, there's a map of the north end and south end where they're located and things.
Oh, I can take my
copy.
Thank you.
Do you have that digital? Can you email it to all of us?
Yeah, I can submit it to
a cell phone.
Thank you.
Oh, I got it.
So, Heather, do you have the direction you're looking for?
None of the ones on my street are registered.
I mean, yeah, I think so. Obviously, it's going to require a lot more discussions to get everybody on the same page with where we want to go, make sure that the ordinance is actually enforceable. You know, for example, the solid waste standard in there, it says trash cans won't go out until the day before trash and they'll be immediately put away. Like, I don't do that, so my trash can's still sitting out there. Mostly because recycle's late today, but how, you know, we can't enforce that. So we need to have standards that are enforceable if we're gonna change it. It needs to be realistic, more realistic than it is now. So with direction, we can start working on it, throwing together some more detailed ideas and then come back to you guys.
Yeah, would you like us to come back to another briefing with a draft summary of the changes that we're looking to make to the ordinance? More than just bullet points, but some rewrite sections.
Well, we should have more direction where the Florida League of Cities is gonna go by that time too.
I think Sandy and I can confirm it will be one of the top two priorities coming out of municipal administration.
Okay.
We did a vote at the last meeting, and the top two items were, well,
that
STDRs
was the number one.
That was the number one.
STDR was number one. Yeah. But, yeah.
So it will be a priority issue for Florida League.
Can we go back to Flagler and see how they're doing? Have they made any changes? Like, I don't know if we've revisited some of these guys, because I know it wasn't even our city attorney,
it was
Denise,
yeah.
I know she went to a lot of different cities and kind of did this choose your own adventure legislation, so
it's really close to what Flagler County still has. It actually looked at theirs today to see if they had made any substantial changes, and it's real similar. We also have a lot of provisions in there that mirror St. Augustine, so everybody's kind of taken a similar approach. I also did look at Fernandina, because theirs is a much shorter ordinance. I think that probably is a better approach, the way they've done it, and requiring, again, everybody to register with a little bit simpler program, getting that contact information, knowing they're out there, and knowing, again, who to call when there's a problem. I think that's one of the big issues we have right now, is we don't have that.
That was my next comment. Whenever we finish this revision, can we put together an infographic, something catchy, and really, especially maybe before the next spring season, just blast that out, because I think that there is a lot of confusion on the part of the neighbors of who to call when, what they can call for, what the rules are. You know, make it simple,
education.
And here's how you can get more information. But I think we need to really put it out there that this, we're doing what we can, here's what it is, and here's how you can help us. Because I've been to a couple in Jacksonville Beach where I've had friends staying, where the neighbors are clearly on deck. They know what they can, and there's some passive aggressive signage, there's some cameras, there's, you know, they really
kind of signage.
And those, and you walk in, you open that door, and there's a sign, please do not be loud after 10 o'clock, please call this if there's any issues. So the owners, the short-term rental owners, know that those neighbors are watching them and are gonna hold them to account. So
yeah,
I think that makes a big difference to empower, not in a vigilante per se.
We'll pull Mr. Board into this process. It'll be
pleasantly
surprised. Yeah, she'll be able to come up with a good infographic for this. I can't read this.
Well, and you know, and Mike, I know we could probably reach out to the League of Cities and find out. I mean, we get a little bits and pieces of information at these policy meetings, policy committee meetings, you know, of what some people are doing, what some cities are doing, but maybe we could try to see if we could, through that route, find some cities that seem to have some success with managing.
We can certainly do that. Yeah. Reach out to Tara and see what she can get for us.
Of course, the best ordinances are the ones prior to 2011 when they could
do
what they wanted. Those are those. So we have to be careful.
I keep wishing for a time machine.
Sure.
It's not working.
Okay. Thank you. We've already been through the miscellaneous items. I don't know if any elected officials have anything they want to report out on?
For our last League of City meeting, we did vote on our top two things, and The number one was the mobility plans. Apparently they want to address mobility plans. I voted for a sovereign immunity. I was hoping that we would address that because we're on borrowed time with that policy as far as I'm concerned.
Committee are you on?
Land development and economic land use and economic development. And then the second issue was going to be residential infill zoning. So those, it looks like the primary is going to be mobility plans and fees.
Yeah.
That's
good.
So, I'm hearing it's a nightmare. So.
For municipal administration, we had short-term vacation rentals was the number one priority, and number two was the Form 6. Just so that every council member can know, there's been a buzz at the state level that there's going to be legislation introduced this year that would require all elected officials and city and county managers to fill out Form 6 instead of Form 1. And there's a concern that that will be a big hindrance to recruiting people at the local level to actually serve in those positions.
So, I don't know what a Form 6
is. Form 1 on steroids. You have to report,
absolutely
everything. It took my...
Everything financial about you has to be down on
it. It took my accountant, I think, 3 weeks to get mine down.
Oh, Lord.
It's bad.
Needless to say, there are some municipal.
It doesn't matter.
That would change.
It doesn't matter. I mean, it's so detailed. I mean, if you own a single stock, you've got to know.
I do.
Oh, well,
I do.
You're lucky in there. But
like I said, nothing would change for me.
Yeah,
needless to say, our panel of elected officials and some city managers all said that needs to be a priority, and that looks like it's going to be the number two priority coming out of our administration.
You will not get anybody to run for municipal government if they have to do Form 6.
That's what everybody's concerned
about.
They
won't know how to do it. It's the most complicated thing. It really is. It's brutal. It's brutal.
So if any other report outs? If not, I just wanted to walk through with you real quick.
I wanted to mention something or ask a question at least, because I'm getting questions from people about the 16 charter amendments, and
we just put on the website today.
Okay, we need to make it easier for people to find
yes,
the information.
On the front page, when you log on to Jack's Beach's homepage on the internet, we now have a news blurb on there regarding the 16 charter amendments. When you click on it, there's a link that takes you to the ballot title, the ballot summary, the actual ordinance that was adopted by council, the strike through and underline of
Good.
All of the language for each of the sections of the charter that would be amended.
Good.
Jacob put that up there today, and he will be doing a blast out on our social media to let everyone know that that's out there as well.
Okay, good.
So, we got it.
Good, thank you. Because I've been sharing your meeting presentation with people,
That's funny, because I sat down last night, actually, and I had it on my phone, and I did 16 bullet points, one for each charter, and, you know, whatever it was, and just a simple one-liner sentence, and then the link, I got the link, and it's ready to go, but I wasn't going to post it until we got closer to election. So if you do it today, a week out, they're going to go, hey, about these 16.
So the only last thing I have for you, we only have 2 minutes before the microphones are going to turn on. Mm-hmm. For November, we have a meeting on the 7th, a meeting on the 21st. The 14th was going to be a briefing. That is going to be the special council meeting for the selection of Councillor Stokes' replacement, along with the ordinance items that you heard Karen talk about earlier tonight. We are still looking at trying to find a date that works for council and works for Cliff and Sandy to have a conversation about VLSC. So we are still looking at a date in November. It will not be on one of those 3 days.
Wasn't that November
7th? I thought we got it.
Did Chris already confirm
that?
Yeah,
wasn't it November 5th?
Second.
Okay, good. She was out today, so I didn't know if she had contacted you all, but
that
looks like our meeting schedule for the month of November.
Okay.
When is Bill sworn in?
21st,
I believe, will be.
Both. Well, Black and White, Georgette, and then Jesse, and
what
you
call it?
Bill.
You what?
Black and White.
Black and White.
That's a nonprofit term.
Black and White. So that's
Gavel and Grip and Gavel, or something. There's many.
So I've got nothing else for you all, and they're getting ready to start up in the next room. So everybody have a great night. We'll see you next Monday.